Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter...
Is the microphone on? Doesn't sound like it.
Is it? Is it okay?
Okay.
1 Corinthians chapter 10. And tonight we want to do two things. First of all, verses 23 through 33, which we will call the fellowship of idolatry. And then we'll look at the rest of the chapter under the caption of freedom within limitations. But first of all, we're looking at the fellowship of idolatry. Passage covered is 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 14 through 22. We just barely touched this last time, but it is an important section, so we need to back up and do it well. Fellowship with idolatry. And remember, by way of introduction to this section of verses, the first thing to note is, what is the purpose of 1 Corinthians 10, 14 through 22 relative to the entire chapter, or relative to Paul's argument? And the answer to what is the purpose of 1 Corinthians 10, 14 through 23 is simple. It is the application and the expansion of 1 Corinthians 10, 7. 10, 7, in reviewing the history of Israel, has said, "Do not be idolaters, as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play." And all he gives us in this verse is, do not be idolaters. No expansion, no particularization, just a general statement, do not be idolaters. Now, in verses 14 through 22, that is going to be made specific and it is going to be applied. That is the purpose of the verses in front of us. The second thing is, what, in essence, is the message of 1 Corinthians 10, 14 through 23? And the message involves something that the Corinthians simply were not aware of, which is this. All idolatry, or we could put there, all false worship, or all idolatry, is a manifestation of demonism. And Paul treats this as though the Corinthians understood the idol, they understood that it was nothing, they understood that things offered to idols were nothing, but they apparently did not understand that idolatry is a manifestation of demonism. And that is the theme that runs through 1 Corinthians 10, 14 through 23. So, what have we had? Don't be idolaters. Now we're going to find out how they can do that. And we'll find out that the idolatry did not come about by the Corinthians adopting little wood or stone images into their houses, but something different. And then Paul will take us right to the heart of false religion, which is demonism. So we start out then with, number one, a principle, or the principle, on which Paul wants to build, 1 Corinthians 1, 14 through 18. The principle on which he wants to build. Note, first of all, that when we come down to this section, verse 14, it begins with the word, therefore. And the word, therefore, simply says that what I am saying in verse 14 is an implication of verse 13. So, therefore, ties to 10:13. 10:13 is a well-known verse. No temptation has overtaken you, but such is common to man, but God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation provide a way of escape also that you may be able to bear it. Now, I've noticed in Bible study that there is a typical pattern that whenever you have a well-known verse, and this is certainly a well-known verse, whenever you have a well-known verse, the verses before it and the verses after it are inevitably neglected. And you can see why. Verse 13 is dramatic. It's a verse you can grab onto. And therefore, you focus on that verse. And perhaps if we would have begun tonight by saying, do you know 1 Corinthians 10:13? And then ask, do you know that 1 Corinthians 10:13 has an integral connected part with verse 14? And I think by and large we'll say, no, I don't even know what verse 14 is. But notice, Paul has bothered to say by the beginning word of verse 14, the word therefore, a connective, that the two tie together. And the way it is verse 13 is a statement, and verse 14, tied in with the word therefore, is an inference or a conclusion. Inference, conclusion, using those in a connected way. Which means if we properly understand these two verses, we will not separate them, but we will see them as tied together. And I think when we do that, we get some very enlightening information. Reading the last part of verse 13, with the temptation, God will provide the way of escape. And so the statement there is, in any temptation, there is a way of escape or a way out. Now, logically, you would think this. If there is a way of escape from temptation, what is it? What is the way out? Well, since there is a way of escape, we should therefore do something. And the obvious thing to do would be use the way of escape, but what is it? Well, it's tied in verse 14. Therefore, my beloved, here's your way of escape. Flee. Idolatry. So the way of escape is, tie it together, to flee. And that integrates contextually the two verses that are very, very important. We also noted that in the New Testament, fleeing is tied in to two things. Number one, a believer should flee anything that competes with the lordship of Christ. We should flee anything that competes, and I'll only list these because we did them last time, with the lordship of Christ. And the second category of flee verses is we should flee desires whose intent is sensual. We should flee desires or paths whose intent is sensual. And let me simply give you the passages that go with them. The first one, we should flee anything that competes with the lordship of Christ. And I would use the verse in front of us, 1 Corinthians 10:14. Idolatry, obviously, competes with His lordship. Therefore, flee it. Desires whose intent are sensual would be 2 Timothy 2:22, flee youthful lusts, would be 1 Corinthians 6:18, which says, flee immorality, and 1 Timothy 6:11, which he talks about the love for material things, which obviously is the fulfillment of the sensual, we should flee. And therefore, Paul tells us how to handle those things, promises the way out, then he tells how we take the way out and what the principle is. Also, I think the word flee teaches something else. It teaches that we're not to allow ourselves to become involved in temptation. And then once we deliberately allow ourselves to be involved in it, expect God to deliver us. We weren't supposed to get into that place in the first place, and that is expressed by the idea of we ought to flee. Now, I take it that verse 15 fits into the context by saying this. The test of your maturity and wisdom is how well you take what I'm just telling you. Therefore, verse 15, I speak as to wise men, you judge what I say. And the clear implication is if you're a wise man, you will agree with what I have to say. Now, before we move on, we ought to add one other thing. And that is, there is a key term that we must understand for the rest of the passage. It is the term koinonia. K-O-I-N-O-N-I-A. Koinonia. Reading with verse 16. Is not the cup of blessing which we bless a sharing? Koinonia. In the blood of Christ, is not the bread which we break a koinonia, or sharing, in the body of Christ? Now that word will become extremely important for what we have in the following context. Koinonia is usually translated fellowship. The ideas involved with fellowship are basically three. First of all, fellowship has to do, or koinonia, is the sharing with sharing of something which one possesses with another. Sharing of something with another. In other words, there is a possessor of something and there's a benefactor. And you do not have fellowship or koinonia unless you have both possessor and fellowshipper. When we think of the word fellowship, koinonia, and if you let your mind go to when Christians use the word fellowship, you have to remember that there are two kinds of language out there. There is Christianese, and then there is biblical understanding of terms. Probably you understand fellowship in terms of Christianese, which is a bunch of us get together, drink coffee, and have what? Fellowship. Do you know what fellowship, koinonia, applies to more than anything else in the New Testament? The offering. Let's take a look at it. Romans 15. Romans 15. The most common fellowship is the offering. I would not, in the light of the usage in the New Testament, hesitate to say, when it's offering time, would the ushers please come for the koinonia? Because that is by far the biggest usage of it in the New Testament. The sharing of one's material possessions. Chapter 15, 26 and 27. Paul says, "For Macedonia and Achaia have been pleased to make a contribution for the poor among the saints in Jerusalem. Yes, they were pleased to do so, and they are indebted to them, for if the Gentiles have shared," there's our koinonia, "they have shared in their spiritual things, they are indebted to minister to them in material things." So notice in Romans chapter 15, 26 and 27, the thing which they shared was money, or we'll put it material things, it didn't have to take the form of money, but it refers to money in Romans chapter 15, 26 and 27. 2 Corinthians 8. 2 Corinthians 8. Koinonia is more often money than anything else in the New Testament, though not exclusively so, as we'll see. 2 Corinthians 8, 4. Well, let's get 3 to get the context. Paul is speaking of giving, and he says in verse 3, "I testify that according to their ability and beyond their ability, they gave of their own accord, begging us with much entreaty for the favor of koinonia in the support of the saints." So notice here it is clearly a financial context of support, and it is called koinonia. Chapter 9, verse 13. Paul says, "Because of the proof given by this ministry, there will glorify God for your obedience to your confession of the gospel of Christ and for the liberality of your koinonia to them and to all." So 9:13 again refers to financial giving. Galatians 6:6. Galatians 6:6. Where you have the interaction between those taught and those who teach. And in verse 6, we have, "Let the one who is taught the word share, have koinonia in all good things with him who teaches." And most interpreters take that to be in the financial support of their teachers. Finally, Philippians 4. Philippians 4 and verse 15. Verse 15, Paul says, "You yourselves also know, Philippians, that at the first preaching of the gospel, after I departed from Macedonia, no church shared koinonia, verb form, with me in the matter of giving and receiving, but you alone." So notice very heavily, Philippians 4:15, very heavily is the use of koinonia in the New Testament, usually refer to financial sharing. Second, it can also refer to having joint participation. That implies approval and for which one is held responsible. It's having joint approval that implies joint participation that implies approval and for which one is held responsible. Repeating once again, it refers to a joint participation that implies you approve of what you are participating in and for which God holds us responsible. Once again, the key idea is you're having a joint participation, and that participation implies that whoever or whatever you are cooperating with has your approval, and for which approval God holds us responsible. For example, we'll look at two passages. 2 John 2. 2 John 2. Now, what these two verses will show us is that who we have joint participation with is very important, and we ought to be very careful about that which we participate in, because God will view it as approval, and He will hold us responsible for that cooperation. 2 John 2, 2. That's not right. Oh, 11, I'm sorry. 2 John 11. Verse 11. And get verse 10 to get the context. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him into your house and do not give him a greeting. For the one who gives him a greeting has koinonia, participates in his evil deeds. And I, as I read this, I take it that they thought they were merely being cordial, but John says if you are cordial and extend koinonia, that implies approval, and God holds you responsible of actually participating in their evil deeds, even though you did not do them. So koinonia with evil is a way of sinning without committing the sin. And doubtless the people that may have opened their homes to the apostate teacher didn't do the apostate teaching, but they encouraged it. They approved it. They opened the door. They said, "We will listen to you," and thus that is approval for which held responsible. This is also true in our passage we'll be looking at tonight, 1 Corinthians 10, 20. And the context is not that the Corinthians had idols in their houses or believed that idols had any power, but when they went to the idol temple, Paul says you're having koinonia because of the place you're in. And when you have koinonia in that pagan temple, you are having koinonia with demons. Chapter 10, verse 20. "No, but I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to become sharers or have koinonia with demons." It's interesting, isn't it? Believers having fellowship, koinonia with demons. And why? How would they do that? Well, by going to the idol temple, would be viewed as participating in it, thus approving it, thus held responsible for that. Third, and this is the broadest meaning of koinonia, it means working with someone else or working with another in any joint effort, be it spiritual or otherwise. Koinonia doesn't have to be spiritual. Working with another in any joint effort, spiritual or otherwise. Let me give you the otherwise first. Luke 5:10. And Luke 5:10 talks about a fellowship and a koinonia that has nothing to do with anything spiritual. As a matter of fact, basically what it refers to is fishing buddies. And when they participated together in the activity of fishing, koinonia took place. Chapter 5 of Luke and verse 10. And so also James and John, sons of Zebedee, who were, and there's our word, koinonia, with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, "Do not fear, from now on you will be catching men." And what was the area in which they were partners? They're fishing partners, fishing buddies, and that is called koinonia. Galatians 2 is a koinonia or joint participation in a spiritual activity. Galatians 2, 6 through 9. And Paul is talking about the Jerusalem Council when there was an agreement of among him and others. And verse 6 says, "From those who were of high reputation, what they were makes no difference to me. God knows no partiality. Well, those who were of reputation contributed nothing to me. For on the contrary, seeing I had been entrusted with the gospel to the Gentiles, or uncircumcised, and Peter with the gospel to the Jew, or the circumcised. For he who effectually worked for Peter in his apostleship to the circumcised effectually worked for me also to the Gentiles. And recognizing the grace that had been given to me, James and Cephas and John, who were reputed to be pillars, gave to me and to Barnabas the right hand of koinonia." And what were they participating together in? They were participating together in the spread of the gospel. Now, with that, let's go back to 1 Corinthians 10. We've established the principle, and now let's make an application of that principle. It will all hinge on the word koinonia. 10:19 through 22 is the application. And we can follow Paul easily on this because he's going to tell us what he doesn't mean, then what he does mean. First of all, what is not meant? What is not meant? The conclusions we're not supposed to come to, verse 19. Verse 19 reads, "What do I mean, then, that a thing sacrificed to idols is..." We ought to back up again to verse 16. "Is not the cup of blessing which we bless a koinonia in the blood of Christ?" So the principle is when we take communion, we're saying we have fellowship with Christ. In other words, the cup and the bread in itself is nothing, but it symbolizes something that's real, doesn't it? Now, can you see where Paul's going? When we partake of the cup and the bread, which in itself is nothing, it is a symbol of something real, isn't it? It's a symbol of a real union. So that, again, when we take the cup, it's grape juice, isn't it? And that in itself is nothing more than grape juice. And the bread is nothing more than bread. The symbols are not the point. But the point is, when you take that symbol, what are you saying? There is a real, living relationship behind the symbols. Now, what Paul is going to say is this. The idol doesn't amount to a hill of beans. The thing offered to idols doesn't mean anything. But there's something real behind it. And what is the real that is behind it? Demonism. So, first of all, then, coming down to verse 17, since there is one bread, and we are many, are one body, for we all partake of the one bread. Look at the nation of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices sharers of the altar? In other words, when you partook of the altar in the Old Testament, you had fellowship with it. Now, verse 19. What then do I mean? Do I mean that the thing sacrificed to idol is anything? Or that an idol is anything? Answer, no. So, it is not a reference to an idol. I don't mean that. It is not a reference to things offered to idols. Now, here's where Paul begins to expand and informs the Corinthians that in false worship, there is a third element that you're not seeing. And the third element that is involved is the unseen demons that are behind it. So, you have verse 20, no, but I say the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons. So that comes on then in verse 20 with what Paul did mean. What is not meant, now what is meant? Can we put it this way? Behind the things that mean nothing, there is something. Put it that way. Behind what means nothing in itself is something. And the things that mean nothing would be the idol and the things offered to idols. But he says you're missing an important fact. That behind those things that in themselves don't mean anything, there is something. And what that something, then, is spelled out to them in verse 20. He says, no, there's no meaning to the things offered to idols or idols. I say that the things with the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to become sharers or participants in demons. So the idea involved is simply this. When the Corinthians went into the idol temple, they could in themselves say, that's a block of wood. They could say, that's just meat, and it's nothing in itself. But in the fact that you are there, you are having a fellowship that is real. And that real fellowship is found in verse 20, which is shares with demons. Now notice he goes ahead and gives some of the dangers of false worship, which is idolatry. And one of them is this. Participation in false worship is satanic involvement, whether we know it or not. Don't you get the flavor that the Corinthians apparently were going to be kind of surprised that they didn't think that their involvement in the false worship really meant anything? And Paul comes along and says, whether you know it or not, you are involved in demon worship. And next, and it's in verse 21, involvement in false worship excludes true worship. And that is verse 21. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Now, will God be indifferent to their involvement? Verse 23. Or do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? We are not stronger than He, are we? In other words, there will be discipline involved. And we ought to note, coming down to verse 23, it is possible for a genuine believer to become involved in false worship. The Corinthians were. They apparently did not know it, and so they had to move away from it. Now, when we talk about demonism and idols, we must remember from the historical standpoint what we said last time. Some of the great artworks of antiquity and some of the great architecture of antiquity, the majority of it, is ultimately demon worship. As we said last time, we like to go to the Acropolis or the Pantheon and look at the beautiful architectural accomplishments. Nothing in the world wrong with that. But we must remember that that building is a manifestation of demonic activity expressed in the Greek worship systems. All right, now to close out chapter 10, let's caption this, Freedom Within Limits. freedom within limits. And again, we will start with verse 22 or 23, which states a principle, reiterates a principle that Paul has brought before us before in verse 23. All things are lawful, but not all things are profitable. All things are lawful, but not all things edify. Now, the first thing then that Paul is reminded is this. The Christian life cannot operate successfully under the motto, all things are lawful. Christian life cannot operate under the motto, all things are lawful. That is not adequate. Now, there is truth to that statement, and we have noted that obviously that has to be modified in some way, and the modification that when Paul asserts that all things are lawful is obvious. It is lawful, assuming there is no specific forbidding of it on the part of God, or it's not in the area of things, it's not obviously lawful for a believer to steal. Obviously, from 1 Corinthians, it is not lawful for the believer to commit fornication. And Paul has taken that parameter and recognized that we have certain things which are liberty areas, but you cannot operate successfully in the Christian life with that as your motto. At the same time, you can't surrender it. What you have to do is look at it in the light of certain things. And so Paul is simply going to say, possession of liberty. Possession of liberty does not mean it should be exercised. Possession of liberty does not mean it should be exercised. There are other considerations besides the fact that it is a liberty. And what Paul and ultimately the Holy Spirit is going to depend upon is that every individual believer must exercise good judgment using the right principles in his exercise of liberty. So the believer must exercise judgment. Learning to use liberty is a very maturing thing. Paul does not say that since you can misuse liberty, we're going to take it away from you. Paul fights for the believer's liberty. At the same time, he does not list rules for them under liberty. He gives them principles. And whenever you give a principle, then you are resting on good judgment. It's much like telling a teenager when you go out, drive carefully. Well, what does that mean, drive carefully? The legalistic mentality would say there are 463 elements in driving safely, and it would make a book out of them that you had to take with you. Drive safely says be alert, use good judgment, and of course when we use good judgment we grow and we develop, and this is what Paul is saying in this particular context. Now notice the modifying principles are two things. All things are lawful, but not all things are profitable. So he is simply going to say here, that liberty must be considered what is profitable and what edifies. Must consider what is profitable and what edifies. And that calls upon the believer's judgment to do that. Now, when Paul says this in 1 Corinthians 10:23, keep your finger here and go back to chapter 6, where he started the subject. In chapter 6, comparing these two things together, in chapter 6, when Paul talks about liberty, considering whether we exercise liberty, considering whether it is profitable and edifies, in 6:12, basically, Paul applies that to himself. And thus, we have in chapter 6, verse 12, all things are lawful for me. But not all things are profitable. And I think implied there is for me. Because of the last clause, all things are lawful for me, but I, see, he's talking about himself personally, will not be mastered by anything. So, the chapter 6, verse 12 says, liberty must be exercise of liberty must consider what is profitable and edifies in relationship to me personally. Now, in chapter 10, Paul is going to say the same thing, only it is going to get bigger. And chapter 10, verse 12, he uses the word profit again, and the difference is the principle considers primarily not just himself, but it applies to others. Chapter 6, how it relates to me. Chapter 10 says that is not enough. You can't just consider yourself, you must consider others. Now, how do we know that's what he has in mind in chapter 10? Well, first of all, if we go to verse 23, and he says, not all things are profitable. The word profitable ought to be traced down to, and you say, profitable for who? Just you? No. Take the word profitable and go down to verse 33. And notice the profit that he's considering is not just himself, but it's others. So verse 33 reads, just as I also please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of the many. So I would take the idea of verse 33, take it back to verse 23, and simply saying, in your exercise of liberty, true, you must consider yourself, but now in chapter 10 we need to expand that and point out that we need to consider others. Also, we should say something about the word edify, another thing that shows this is what Paul has in mind, notice verse 24. Let no one seek his own good, but that of his neighbor. Paul is looking outward now in this section on liberty. Basically, if you trace the word liberty through Paul's use, I think you can say this safely. When Paul talks about edification, he means to advance spiritually. Paul's use of the word edify means to advance spiritually. And Paul is going to point out that in knowing how to exercise liberty, we've got to consider more than ourselves, we've got to consider others. So with that principle now restated, he now issues a command. And it is the next verse, chapter 10 and verse 24. Now, the first thing we've got to start out with in verse 24 is a slight problem of interpretation. Reading through verse 24, if you're a good student of God's Word, one of the first things you're going to do is eliminate one word. And that is going to be the word good. And the reason you eliminate that is because the italics indicates it's not in the original. So, little practice in interpretation. Whenever you come to a verse that has a word in italics, read the verse twice. The first time with the word in, and second time with it out. And if the meaning is different with it omitted, then you've got something you've got to look at. So, verse 24. Let no one seek his own good. Now go back and leave it out. Let no one seek his own. And notice the word good has been given to us as sort of a limiting parameter. And therefore, we have to fill in something there. So, the question would be, what word must be understood? In English, we have understood subjects and understood verbs. It simply means we grasp that it's there. If someone yells fire, you understand there is a fire, and no problem. Now, what word must be understood? New American Standard Bible has given us good. The King James Version, at least the one that I have seen, and I know there are a new King James Version that may not do this, translate the verse this way. Let no one seek his own, but that of his neighbor's or another's
What's the word? You got it out there?
Wealth. That's interesting. Another's wealth. Now, what are we going to do? Who's right? And the answer to that is, which one do you like the best? You know, you Christians say, I really like that translation. And I like the way it's worded. That's not the point. The point is it's faithful. It's often said, translations are like beautiful women. Like women. If beautiful, not faithful. If faithful, not beautiful. I shouldn't have said that. That's from Dallas Seminary. Dr. S. Lewis Johnson used to say that, so I don't... That's just only quoting. I didn't make that up. So what must be understood in the context? Are we just going to guess at it? No, there is an answer, and I think it is much better than either one of them, and that is this. Principle of interpretation. When Paul leaves a word to be understood, he expects us to fill it in from the context. Now, that's easy to do. Let no one seek his own what. Try verse 33. Just as I also please all men in all things, not seeking my own, what's the word? Profit. Doesn't that sound better in verse 25? Let no one seek his own profit. And so the meaning of the understood word will come from verse 33. And that's better than good, though there's nothing really wrong with that, and it's certainly better than wealth, which could convey a totally wrong idea. But the understood word comes from the context, namely from verse 33. So verse 24 then would read, let no one seek his own profit, but that profit of another or that of his neighbor. Notice also with the verb seek, we're not to be passive about this. We're not to say, well, if it happens to be to their benefit, I'm very glad. We're to seek it. So this idea of the active verb, active voice, is we're to go after this and we're to be very much involved in it. Okay, now with that, Paul is going to make an application. And the application will be two case histories. And the application is in 25 through 27. Paul is going to get down to what we would say brass tacks now on this issue of idols and idol temples and eating in the right place. First of all, verses 25 through 27, we will caption, eating without asking. Eating without asking. Verse 25 and 26. And we begin with the description of the circumstance. Circumstance described. Verse 25. Eat anything that is sold in the meat market. And Paul is going to go in two directions. The circumstances, first of all, in relationship to our personal life, then in relationship to their social life. First of all, in relationship to their personal life. And that is described in these verses. First of all, in their personal life, verse 25, eat anything that is sold in the meat market. Now, we've got a little problem. How do we relate verse 25 to what we had in verses 20 and 21? In verses 20 and 21, does it sound like you ought to eat of these things in the marketplace or not? Well, 20 and 21 has been pretty strong. He's going to say, when you do that, you're participating with demons. Well, then how can he turn around in verse 25 and say, eat anything in the marketplace or in the meat market? And I take it the answer to that is this. 20 and 21 envisions their presence in the temple. It envisions their presence in the idol temple. When you are there, you're participating in demonism. I take it, however, when you get down to verse 25, that when the meat leaves the idol temple, it loses its idol significance. And that would recognize these two. Because notice the eating is in two different places. One is the meat that's come down to the marketplace. The other is involvement in the idol temple. So it somehow loses significance upon arrival in the marketplace. And thus you have the statement of verse 25 is, go ahead and eat anything that is there. Second, not only are you to eat anything that is there, but avoid any questions that might trouble your conscience. In other words, it is not wise to seek difficulty. Verse 25, eat anything that is sold in the meat market without asking questions for your conscience sake. In other words, don't inquire where this meat has been. Don't ask questions. Don't start picking and punching on it to see and asking the man that's selling it, what is the history of this meat? Just keep quiet. And do that for the sake of your conscience. Now, you say, well, how could Paul ever justify anything like this? Well, notice verse 25, circumstances described, and now second, his advice justified. His advice is going to now be justified in verse 26. And the reason we know he's about to justify it is the first word of verse 26, which is the flag word for. Here's why you can do it. And notice his justification is this: for the earth is the Lord's and everything that is in it. Or let us put it this way. The source of the meat is pure, though its use is perverted. Its source is pure, even though its use is perverted. So that we can underline two alliterated words, pure and perverted. And when you look at that meat in the idol place, it is both pure and perverted. It is perverted in the way that the false religion has used it. But are you forgetting something? Have you forgotten the source? God made it. And he justifies this coming out of Psalm 24, verse 1. For the earth is the Lord and everything that is in it. So, then, when you find yourself going to the marketplace, eat anything there, don't ask questions that will get answers that will give you a conscience problem. You need a scriptural basis for that? Well, there is one. Everything in that meat market has its source in God and was made by Him, and therefore you can freely partake of it. Now, after talking about then their personal life, Paul then moves to their social life, or in relationship to social life. And that, again, gives us the circumstances. Verse 27, if one of the unbelievers invites you, don't go. Come out from among them and be separate. Now read this again. If one of the unbelievers invites you, do not go, for believers are to be separate from unbelievers. I think it's very interesting here, implied. Notice Paul does not forbid social intercourse with unbelievers. He missed something there, didn't he? And so notice the remark then is the believer is to maintain his testimony, obviously, but this does not mean that if one of the unbelievers invites you, you do have the freedom to go. Christians were not forbidden to break pagan friendships, though they were certainly to maintain their proper priorities. Now let's read it another way. If one of the unbelievers invites you, pray about it. If one of the unbelievers invites you, try to determine what God's will is. Seek His will on the matter. Now let's read it right. If one of the unbelievers invites you and you wish to go, What's he saying? It's your volition. Do you wish to go? Then go. Do you not wish to? Then do not go. And so notice it is a matter of volition on the part of the believer that is there. Now, in the continuation of that verse, if an unbeliever invites you and you wish to go, and notice this is going to expand the principle we just had, eat anything that is set before you without asking questions for conscience sake. In other words, don't create an issue where an issue should not be raised. That's what you do under the principle of eating without asking. Now, I think this has some application. You may not agree. I think this has some application in the fact that very often you are enjoying, or you mention that this is Easter. And along comes someone to inform you so that your conscience will forever be bothering you about Easter. And they will say, Easter comes from Ishtar, and will take you back through Babylonian mystical type thing. I think Paul's advice would simply be this. Don't ask questions that create conscience problems, and thus with them in this case. Now, let's change it around and move from eating without asking to the second situation, which we will call eating when informed. Eating when informed. And that is verse 28. But if anyone should say to you, this meat is sacrificed to idols, do not eat it, for the sake of the one who informed you and for conscience sake. So the first question that would arise here would be, who's the informer? Who told you? So let's put it in the form of the question. Or put it this way, in verse 28, but if anyone, who's the anyone? Who is the informer? Now, there are two possibilities on this. Number one, it could be that you've been invited. Remember, this is the home of an unbeliever. And you've been invited to the unbeliever's home along with a fellow Christian. And that fellow Christian, in the midst of the meal, divulges the information that this is idol meat. So let's make it, first of all, this is a fellow believer. Could be. Now, when the fellow believer divulges that information, did he do the right thing or the wrong thing? He did exactly what he's not supposed to do. What did the verses, verse 27 or 25, eat whatever is sold, don't ask questions. If anyone invites you, verse 27, and you wish to go, eat anything that's said, and don't ask questions. And up pops a fellow believer who asks questions or divulges information. You should say, well, you Claude, if you kept your mouth shut, I could have finished my steak. And if you'd listened to what Paul had said, I could have finished my steak. So I'm going to finish it anyway, because you're wrong. And you would be right, he was wrong. But there's an important issue. Even if he's wrong, consider his conscience. And so notice the response is, do not eat it for the sake of the one who blabbed, of the sake of the one to whom it was an issue, and for his conscience sake. So if it's a fellow believer, again, now that fellow believer manifests a spiritual defect, doesn't he? Remember, Paul had called it a weak conscience. But he's going to say, don't walk on even a weak conscience, even though that is a spiritual defect. All right, let's suppose then the informer is the host. And the host, remember, is an unbeliever. Now, why would the host divulge this information? One of two reasons. One would be out of kindness. He says, now I recognize you're a Christian. I recognize you detest idols. And out of kindness, I do want you to know that this is idol meat. In other words, he could be just being kind to you. Be very much like a host who would say, now, this food has, I know you're perhaps got a health problem or diabetic or something. This is sweetened tea. and we would do it as a kindness. That's possible, that the host is acting in that way. It's also possible that the host is trying to embarrass. Got the Christian there, put out the stuff, and say, okay, believer, that's offered to idols. What are you going to do? Trying to put him on the spot. I don't think that's the tone. The reason I don't think that's the tone is, doesn't it appear that the unbeliever is trying to be cordial? Do you invite people over to dinner for the specific purpose of embarrassing them? You ever do that? I'm sure it's been done. But normally, that's not why you have people over for dinner. You have people over for dinner out of kindness. And I take it then that if this is an unbeliever that is here, then you have the advice that in verse 28 that you are to stop eating. Now, with 29 on through the end, we'll pick that up next time. Paul is going to talk about, well, why in the world should someone else's conscience be my judge? And then he will bring that to a conclusion, but we want to do that in detail. And we'll drop at this point then, you've been informed that this is idol meat, and in deference to the conscience of another, you have pushed back the plate of food and you're going to eat no more. Now, what about the questions of, have you been wronged? And all of this coming into the picture, Paul will answer them beginning in verse 29. Father, we're thankful tonight again for your word. We pray that through the wisdom of Paul's teaching under the ministry and under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, we might learn how to adequately handle those areas in which we have liberty in a way that brings glory to your name, in Christ's name.